He wanted, he said, to seize the moment, and President Obama grabbed it early last night.
I'm not the first president to take up this cause, but I am determined to be the last. It has now been nearly a century since Theodore Roosevelt first called for health care reform. And ever since, nearly every president and Congress, whether Democrat or Republican, has attempted to meet this challenge in some way.
The Band-Aid stops here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 10th. I'm Lynn Sherrin for John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, cutting the plastic cord. Americans are paying off their credit cards. And get your chili pots ready. It's kickoff day for the NFL. And then, how to avoid Big Brother at work. But first, good morning to our colleague, Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick in Detroit today at our member station, WDET. Todd, morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Lynn.
So I know you were working and you were listening last night. Was President Obama's speech last night effective enough to make him the last president to take up the health care cause?
Well, he certainly hopes so. He used sort of the classic Obama soaring rhetoric, really trying to make members of Congress, and I think the public, feel responsible for fixing this health care mess that we're in, appealing to people's sense of responsibility, maybe a little bit of shame, some inspiration using the memory of the late Senator Ted Kennedy. So if the president is going to be effective, it's going to be now. He was really pulling out the classic Obama campaign inspirational speech that we came to know in the campaign last year.
Todd Zwillick, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything you need to know this morning. And in the headlines, plenty of news from the president's speech to Congress last night. He continued his push for universal health care, saying it would cost about $900 billion over 10 years. The president noted that's less than the U.S. has spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Louisiana Congressman Charles Bustani gave the official GOP response to the address.
Replacing your family's current health care with government-run health care is not the answer. In fact, it'll make health care much more expensive.
Bustani said it's a mistake to keep pushing the public plan. Meanwhile, new data due out today on the number of uninsured Americans will add to the health care debate. 2 years ago, the Census Bureau found 46 million uninsured Americans. On Capitol Hill, Congress hears testimony today on how the SEC bungled investigations into Wall Street swindler Bernie Madoff's business. An SEC report says the agency failed in its investigation of 6 complaints against him. Markets were up slightly yesterday. The Dow opens next hour at 95.47. The S&P starts at 10.33, and the Nasdaq begins at 20.60. President Obama, of course, in Congress last night to give details of his health care reform plan. What do you think the president left out? What resonated with you the most? Where were you shaking your head?
Hi, my name is Russ Darrow. I'm from Wisconsin. I am an automobile dealer. I think President Obama sounded good. He's a great speaker, and I still am not convinced. I think President Obama is trying to do too much too fast, and I believe it's a genuine lack of trust in both the government running our insurance and also in President Obama himself.
Give us your review, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Lynn Scherr in for John Hockenberry, and here's President Obama last night.
The time for bickering is over. The time for games has passed. Now is the season for action. Now is when we must bring the best ideas of both parties together and show the American people that we can still do what we were sent here to do. Now is the time to deliver on health care.
He could not have been more blunt or more emotional. President Obama laying down the gauntlet on the need for health care reform, putting his case to the American public before a rare joint session of Congress. This morning, The Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us from member station WDET in Detroit to help analyze President Obama's speech. Morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Lynn.
So it was a very fired up, very purposeful President Obama we saw and heard last night. What do you think? Did he get the job done?
He was fired up and very purposeful, and he had to be. You know, all of the reporting we've all been doing and hearing ever since August ended was, boy, the president really lost the message over August at all these town halls and loud screaming. So he really needed to come back in a strong way and regain the message. It was a very effective speech. I was in a room with a bunch of people here in Detroit, and they all responded very strongly to the president's speech. He used that classic Obama style, the soaring rhetoric. You heard it there in the cut. The time for bickering is over. This is the season for action. That those are the kind of words that sort of Obama has put his brand on that really tend to move people emotionally. Whether it moves the Congress legislatively is now the next test.
And Todd, he also talked about the fact that he wasn't going to waste people's time. Let's listen to that.
It's a plan that incorporates ideas from many of the people in this room tonight, Democrats and Republicans. And I will continue to seek common ground in the weeks ahead. If you come to me with a serious set of proposals, I will be there to listen. My door is always open. But know this, I will not waste time with those who have made the calculation that it's better politics to kill this plan than to improve it.
So, Todd, you know a lot about the Congress. Does this mean that the president wants to pass health care reform without the Republicans?
Well, I don't think that he wants to pass it without them, but what he says there is that he's willing to do it if he has to. And I think most of the people who hang around Capitol Hill and follow it closely saw that passage that you just played as a coded message telling Congress, my door is open, I want to do this in a bipartisan way. If I don't get bipartisan support enough to get to 60 in the Senate, I'm willing to do what's called the reconciliation process. We've talked about it before. It's a complicated Senate procedure, but the bottom line is you get to bypass the normal 60-vote requirement and pass health care with just 50 or 51 votes. And it would be a revolutionary they call it the nuclear option, phase two in the Senate. It would really blow up a lot of relationships in the Senate. You know, the president is a guy who prides himself on good relationships, bringing people in.
And being bipartisan, as he has said
all
along.
That's exactly right. And by saying, I'm willing to do this without you, he's saying that attitude is over. In this case, I will go without you. I will press the red nuclear button if I have to.
One more thing, Todd, before we move on. I heard a few new things in the speech. He endorsed medical malpractice liability reform, and he talked about an insurance exchange.
An additional step we can take to keep insurance companies honest is by making a not-for-profit public option available in the insurance exchange. Let me be clear. It would only be an option for those who don't have insurance. No one would be forced to choose it, and it would not impact those of you who already have insurance.
Todd, just an option?
Well, he did. First of all, on medical malpractice, he didn't quite endorse reform. He didn't go that far. He did endorse some pilot projects to see if malpractice reform could work. Democrats don't like that, so that was throwing a bone to the Republicans. On the insurance exchange, it was, I think, the first time we've heard the president endorse that. That idea is in most of the bills, by the way, that are already on Capitol Hill. So a lot of the things that the president endorsed were borrowing from some of the things that are already on the Hill. So members of Congress wouldn't have been surprised by a lot of these proposals. Just real quickly, the president proposed to get rid of, you know, insurance companies' ability to keep you off the rolls for pre-existing conditions, called cherry picking in the industry. They can't drop you.
Right, a very popular notion.
Popular notion. They can't drop you if you get sick. That's called lemon dropping in the industry, cherry picking and lemon dropping. First time the president himself has endorsed those things, but those ideas are in a lot of the bills already on Capitol Hill. So the president was putting his stamp on a lot of the things that are already circulating on the Hill. There was one other specific that we haven't heard before. The president has said before that he won't sign anything that increases the deficit. But what was new last night is that he said he's going to put some teeth on that. He wants language in the bill saying that if the expense of the program does go beyond the revenue, that they would have to do spending cuts. That would be in the law so that it can't increase the deficit even if Congress gets lazy.
Okay, Todd Zwillick, stay with us. We're also joined by David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. David, you were live blogging the speech yesterday evening. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Liz.
Who was the president really talking to, David? Was he talking to voters, to us? Was he talking to the Dems on his side or not on his side? Was he talking to Republicans? What do you think?
Oh, this speech was aimed at multiple audiences, and it was very deft in that way. There were messages for everyone, for the American public, which is very uneasy about the proposed health care changes, and also for everybody in Congress, especially the Republicans. I mean, this was actually a very harsh and partisan speech, which in some ways the president, got a gift in Congressman Joe Wilson from South Carolina rudely shouting, "You lie," because it showed the partisanship is even more bitter on the other side.
Let me interrupt you, David. Let's listen to those moments. First, you talk about this being a harsh speech, the president being very partisan. Let's listen to what the president had to say about one of the thoughts that's been out there.
Some of people's concerns have grown out of bogus claims spread by those whose only agenda is to kill reform at any cost. The best example is the claim made not just by radio and cable talk show hosts, but by prominent politicians, that we plan to set up panels of bureaucrats with the power to kill off senior citizens. Now, such a charge would be laughable if it weren't so cynical and irresponsible. It is a lie, plain and simple.
A lie. Has either of you ever heard the President of the United States talk to a joint session of Congress and call something from the other side a lie? Todd, David?
I'm not sure that I have, Lynn. Maybe David has it. What was really interesting when he said that, it's very often in these speeches you look for David's been writing about the code, the code that you can read from who applauds and who doesn't. And the Republican leadership, as I saw it, now I was watching on TV last night, sat with their arms folded and their hands in their laps when he said that, and the Democratic side just erupted. It may have been an embarrassing moment for some of them.
Go ahead, David. Go ahead.
And this is one where there's no doubt, right? The legislation is not in any way intended to kill off senior citizens. So the president was on firm ground there. But I would point to the very opening of his speech. People overlooked it. It sounded a little bit like, he was tooting his own horn and that of Democrats by talking about the stimulus program and how the economy seems to have stabilized. But in fact, that was a very pointed warning to the House Republicans. None of you voted for that economic stimulus package, not one of you. And now you're going to sit here and you're probably not going to applaud, as Todd's saying, for my health care proposals. But watch out. The first thing seems to have worked. Be careful if you're not going to support the next one.
Well, his exact words were, "We have pulled this economy back from the brink." So, David, what you're saying is the president was putting them on notice.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, let me pull up that. Let's listen to that other moment now, that other stunning moment in the speech. While the president was speaking, and to hear Joe Wilson, the Republican representative from South Carolina, shout back at him.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally.
You lie, is what he said. And if you are watching, you saw Speaker Pelosi turn white. She was furious. David, tell me what was going on.
It was a surprise and stunning eruption. these things just don't happen. It goes against all of the protocol of these kinds of speeches, no matter who is president, no matter who's serving in Congress. The White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel, was there in the audience and quickly afterward turned to some senior Republicans in the House saying, he better apologize. And indeed, quickly there was an apology. And in some ways that, it lent a boost to the president in his effort to describe August with all the protests and rhetoric around the town hall meetings as more about noise than about substantive debate.
David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, thanks for your help. Todd Zwillick, talk to you later.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway. from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Lynn Scherr, and oh, the lure of plastic and the vicious cycle of credit card debt, one of the factors in the economic collapse. But today, guess what? Consumers are decreasing their debt at record levels. In July, Americans paid off $21.6 billion in credit card and other consumer loans. That is the most since 1943, when the Federal Reserve started keeping track. So, do Americans have a new attitude about spending money they don't have? Louise Story, a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, is with us now. Hi, Louise.
Hi.
This is huge, right?
It could be. I mean, if people are going to stick to spending only money they have and not money that they've borrowed, it could really rewrite the rules of our entire economy. It could move us back into a place like where we were after the Great Depression, because, you know, people for years have been buying things with borrowed money.
And remind me, just quick history lesson, after the Depression, people didn't spend money for a while, and then they quickly started spending it again.
Right, but it really took, you know, a couple decades before people spent as much. And, you know, there's two factors here. It's people pulling back, but it's also that it's harder to get credit. You know, in the big housing bubble, people could take money out of their house left and right through home equity loans. And I've interviewed a number of people who got into trouble with home equity loans because what they did is they took out these lines of credit to pay off credit card bills so that they can then borrow more on their credit card. And now, you know, if you got credit card debt, you can't take money out of your house to pay it off. So you might just pay it off the old-fashioned way.
So they used to be borrowing from themselves, basically, when they had nothing to start off with. Okay, what does this mean for the economy? If people are not spending money they don't have, how does the economy grow?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, you might say it's good people aren't spending money they don't have, but for the economy to grow, people have to spend and companies have to spend, and consumer and company spending goes hand in hand, right? Because if companies think that no one's going to come into their shop and buy clothes, they're not going to staff it with as many people. And if they think people aren't going to buy cars, they're not going to produce more cars. And so it goes hand in hand with everything in the economy, with jobs. We look at what we're going to spend, and that's where we staff up for.
Speaking of the economy and jumpstarting it, the White House releases new numbers today on how many jobs this stimulus money has created. Quickly, what are you looking for there?
Well, they put out expectations in February. They said within a couple of years there would be 3 to 4 million jobs. So we've got to see how close to that are we. Of course, what's impossible to know is where would we have been without this stimulus? I mean, you can't do counterfactuals. But, you know, if you kind of read the politics behind this, part of what's going on here is we're looking for what have they created for the regular person. When they announced this in February, Larry Summers, an economic advisor to the president, said this program was meant to help the people who hurt the most by this crisis, which said to me, kind of AKA, help people other than the bankers, because Americans want to see a difference for them.
Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much. That music can only mean one thing. Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen joins us. And now, this music can only mean one thing. I can't stand it. My Mets may be out of it, but baseball is still happening. And now I hear the original Monday Night Football theme song, and today's the first day of the NFL football season. Oh, dear. Here to talk me off the limb is Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor. I mean, really, seriously, football?
Well, this is the thing. Football is America's most popular sport. It's the most watched. It's the most popular. People love football. And if they love football, they love the idea of unity. They love the camaraderie. They love the togetherness of the game. And all summer long, we've been talking about quarterbacks and wide receivers that are really, they don't represent the best of football. What I'm more interested in.
Michael Vick, you think these are not the best of football?
I wouldn't say they represent the core and the reason why we love football.
Okay.
I think you might like football better, and some of our listeners might like it better, if they focus on the best expression is the offensive lines. That's where you see the sense of unity, camaraderie. That's where you see the core and the heart of the game.
So what's the big deal about the offensive lines?
Well, that's literally where a team will make or break a season. A guy like Brady, the quarterback for the New England Patriots, a couple years ago, they went undefeated in the regular season. The next year he comes back, What happens in the first game? He gets someone breaks through the offensive line and tackles him. He's done for the season. Their season was done. Sam Bradford, who plays for Oklahoma State right now, last year they had an incredible offensive line in college. He would have been the number one draft in the NFL this year, but he decided to come back for a second year. What happens in the first game of the season this year at Oklahoma? He gets hit because his offensive line got depleted throughout the offseason. So the offensive line really is the core of the team, and they anchor the squad.
So you want me to look away from the quarterback and go to that other direction on the screen?
Precisely.
Then.
If you like,
I can do that.
If you like Tennessee, if you like Carolina, if you like New Orleans or the New York Giants, if you like the Jets or the Patriots or even the Denver Broncos, those are the best offensive lines in the country, and you'll see that those teams will rise to the top as the season goes on.
Okay, let's get away from football for a minute. I promise I will watch. Let's go to tennis. Our Cinderella moment, our wonderful Melanie Udan lost yesterday in the U.S. Open. 17 years old, how did it happen?
Well, if you have 43 unforced errors in a U.S. Open match and you're trying to get to the semifinals, it's not going to happen. I think she just ran into her wall, and it literally, I think she did it to herself. And it's really sad, but I think that this is not the end of the story with her.
We'll get her back next time.
Without a doubt.
Thank you, Ibrahim Abdelmateen. Takeaway sports contributor. And now let's go to Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thanks, Lynn. Good morning, everybody. It's almost 28 minutes past the hour. In last night's healthcare address, the president challenged his opponents in Congress to put aside partisan issues and work with him to introduce universal healthcare. The president said that the health insurance plan would be fully paid for by spending cuts and tax increases. Now, today, Vice President Biden told NBC that he is optimistic that Congress can overhaul health care.
I believe we will have a bill. I went to Congress a long, long time, been there for 8 presidents. I think we'll have a bill before Thanksgiving.
Now, Vice President Biden's remarks came around about the same time as new data is due out from the Census Bureau on the number of uninsured Americans. 2 years ago, the Census Bureau found 46 million uninsured Americans. We will bring you that update as soon as we can. On Capitol Hill, Congress will hear today from SEC Inspector General David Cotts. He's behind a report detailing the Securities and Exchange Commission's mishandling of investigations into Bernie Madoff's business. Cotts' report says the agency received 6 substantive complaints that raised significant red flags, but failed to complete a proper investigation. Efforts by mortgage companies to help homeowners, in danger of foreclosure may be working. Realty Track reports the number of foreclosure-related filings held steady last month, and bank repossessions dropped 13% from July.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Lynn Scherr, in for John Hockenberry. President Obama called up the history gods last night, acknowledging that the fight for health care reform is nothing new.
I'm not the first president to take up this cause, but I am determined to be the last. It has now been nearly a century since Theodore Roosevelt first called for health care reform. And ever since, nearly every president and Congress, whether Democrat or Republican, has attempted to meet this challenge in some way.
Our next guest, author James Marone, knows this fight well. He is the co-author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office, and he's a political science professor at Brown University. His latest book puts the healthcare debate into some historical context. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Lynn.
So, before we dig into the past, give me your take on the latest presidential healthcare speech last night.
You know, I think Barack Obama needed to give a great speech that did an impossible number of things. He had to get specific, he had to inspire, and he had fire up the base. He can put a check mark on all 3 of those things. He did what he had to do. Now comes the part where everybody else fails. Winning in public is only a small part of this. The really tough job has always been twisting arms behind closed congressional doors.
Well, we have to, in other words, going from dream to reality.
Exactly.
All right, so he gets good marks in the speech area, right?
Yes, I thought he did exactly what he had to do. He really threaded that needle.
Okay, fine. Now let's talk about turning it into law or turning it into fact. From what you know historically, can he do, should he do?
You know, this is one place we know nothing about how good Barack Obama is. It's a place where lots of presidents have fallen flat on their faces. JFK also framed the debate over Medicare, in his case, in 1963 beautifully. He was inspired, fired up, because his dad had just suffered a stroke. So this meant the world to him. But he had no idea about how to move Congress the rest of the way. Harry Truman, the same thing. There's a little test. We'll be able to see how Obama's doing. The fewer leaks we get over the next week, the more seriously this discussion is going on.
Oh, my gosh. I wouldn't put money on that one. There'll be lots of leaks.
And if this takes place in the media, it's trouble. Lyndon Johnson is the most instructive guy on this.
Let me ask you to break it down for me. Give me four healthcare lessons that President Obama can draw from his predecessors.
One, he's got right down. You got to move very fast. And he's got that. Remember, at this time in the Clinton administration, we don't have a bill yet. So he's got that lesson. Lesson number two, pass the credit to Congress. Lyndon Johnson, when he was getting Medicare, was so hidden in his contributions that it was 40 years before we knew he was even involved. Number three, get the public conversation toned down so that it doesn't frighten Congress. I got two more. Number four, remember, this is about your base. The next election is going to have a turnout, the midterm, of about 37-38%. These are base elections. It's not about going to the middle. It's getting your base fired up. And number five, a lesson I hope he doesn't need. Number five, if you lose, lose right. Harry Truman lost, and he kept fighting for his reform, and that reform stayed alive.
I'm fascinated by the one of your lessons, which was leave it to Congress. The president made it very clear last night he was not going to get into too many details.
You know, the great presidents always do lots of details while pretending not to do any. I'm not going to get involved in the details, Lyndon Johnson said over and over again. I trust you. That's the right stance. But when two congressmen disagree, and that's going to happen 1,000 times in the next week, Lynn, you got to get in there and settle it.
Okay.
Get into the details. Pretend you're above them.
James Marone, co-author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. Thank you for that bit of...
Thanks, Lynn.
Thanks for the history lesson. And now now we go to our member station, WDET. They took their own look at health care last night at a town hall forum, and our own Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, spoke at that town hall. Todd, set the scene for us. How did the town hall go last night?
Well, it was a great event, and I say that because there was a pretty big crowd, a real diversity of questions, people asking about everything from their health care costs to how this affects UAW negotiations. You know, United Auto Workers, this is Detroit after all. People wanted to know about medical bankruptcy and whether this bill would protect them from losing the farm, as it were, if their medical costs go up. And people were really, really engaged. There were lines all the way up the aisles to ask questions.
This was a civilized event, right?
Oh, completely civilized,
okay,
which was a nice turn. And I should point out, as opposed to the town halls we've been hearing about, this was mostly a pro-Obama crowd, so there probably weren't a lot of people who wanted to be too angry there.
Okay, let's listen to one of the questions you were asked last night.
Is this true that there's going to be a fine, and in the paper it states that it's going to start at $750? Sounds like a mandate to me.
Whoa, she's talking about the fact that you have to have health insurance. How'd you answer that, Todd?
Right. Well, in fact, it is true. In the Finance Committee draft that's circulating right now, which is the bill that has the most currency in Congress, there's what's called the individual mandate. After a certain time period, people must have insurance, most people, unless they have extreme hardship economically. And if you don't get insurance, yes, the answer is yes. You will have to pay $750 or more, depending on your income. There's a sliding scale. And the answer to that question was yes. And this woman who asked this question, a very good question, had a very interesting response. Listen to what she said.
The people there who are voting on this, they took an oath of office to represent us. This is punitive and unconstitutional against United States citizens of America. How can we contact them to have that removed from there?
And quickly, Todd, your response to her for that?
My response was 202-224-3121, the Capitol Hill switchboard. That was my response.
Okay, it sounds as if the debate has shifted slightly, a little bit less vitriol, at least in Detroit, or at least with this very pro-Obama crowd. Right, Todd?
That's absolutely right. It was a great discussion. There was an economist there, a physician, a professional nurse, and a crowd that was really engaged. They wanted answers and they wanted reform, and then everybody got to stick around and watch the president's speech afterward on a big closed-circuit TV. So I think people left there really edified, and they felt, I talked to a couple of them, they felt like they were a little more educated about what's going on, but there's still some frustration about this process.
Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent from Detroit today, thanks to you. And now let's check in with the headlines. Here's Femi Oke.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour. In the president's address on health reform last night, he challenged opponents in Congress to work with him on universal health care. The president said that under his plan, individuals will be required to carry basic health insurance, just as most states require them to carry auto insurance. Overseas, the main challenger in the Afghan presidential election, Abdullah Abdullah, claims that the election commission is being manipulated by the incumbent president, Hamid Karzai. The Afghan Complaints Commission have thrown out ballots from 51 polling stations in Karzai's strongholds. We have some fresh data in on the job market. The number of people filing for unemployment benefits was up more than expected last week to 550,000 people. They filed for jobless benefits. That's a look at top stories we're watching today.
Thanks, Femi. Coming up, what happens when you email? Who's reading it? Not just the people you're sending it to. More in 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scherr. Here in New York City, a special man was memorialized yesterday by some very special people. You remember him as Walter Cronkite, TV anchor, star journalist. But some of us got to know Walter as an even more stellar human being.
As the son of a sailor, I went out on the sea for adventure.
Jimmy Buffett sailed with Walter Cronkite and sang this song for his sailing buddy. He was one of many who recalled his puckish sense of humor. Buffett had gotten a phone call from their mutual friend, the late Ed Bradley from CBS News, who was questioning whether to wear his earring on 60 Minutes.
Walter said, it doesn't matter whether he wears an earring as long as it's a good story. That was Walter. And then he added, he said, but, he said, you know, almost in that long John Silver tone of voice that he had, he said, if I was going to wear an earring on 60 Minutes, I'd wear one of those big, long, dangly ones.
Former Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart called Walter a great drummer and played his own tribute to the man with Walter's own red drum as part of a set. Later, I ran into Walter's son Chip cradling the drum like a precious gem. I ran into Chip in my apartment building where Walter also lived before he died in July at the age of 92. Everyone there loved him too. He was, some of the staff told me, just such a decent man. Just ask Bill Clinton, who told this story about the summer of the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
He did something for my family that was so simple, and even now it's hard for me to talk about. But in a very tumultuous summer in our personal lives, 1998, we were up on Martha's Vineyard. Walter Cronkite picked up the phone and said, Betsy and I want you to go sailing with us. He said, somebody might take a picture of it, but so what? I'll never forget that. At the time, I could have done with a picture with Walter Cronkite.
Bob Schieffer was one of Cronkite's closest pals at CBS.
I shall never forget one night at a book party here in New York. And I was standing over in a group, and I was talking to Peter Jennings and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw, and we were having a big time. And I thought it would be a great picture if I could get Walter over there with all of them, all of the anchors of the day, and get their picture together. So I sought Walter out, and I found him, and I said, Walter, would you come over here and get a picture with all these guys? And he looked at me, and he said, could you tell them to come over here? I'm trying to get a drink, and I don't want to lose my place at the bar.
Walter Cronkite never took himself too seriously. His wife, Betsy, who died in 2005, made sure of that. Once, when we had dinner together some years ago, at a time when Walter's hearing was just not what it used to be, I asked what the worst part about that was. Easy, he told me. Missing Betsy's one-liners. He did not miss much.
When people of both political parties actually tried to recruit him to run for office, without even asking for his stances on the issues, he said no, to the relief of all potential opponents. And when, even a decade and a half after his retirement, he still ranked first in 7 of 8 categories for television journalists, he was disbelieving that he hadn't won the 8th category, attractiveness.
Walter Cronkite took us to the White House, to China, to space, to a deeper understanding of the world we live in. but mostly he took us as individuals, people he wanted to inform and wanted to know. And that's the way he was.
As the son of a sailor, I went out on the sea for adventure, expanding the view of the captain and crew, like a man just released from indenture, as a dreamer of dreams and a traveling man.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Lynn Scherr in for John Hockenberry, and coming up, your friends aren't the only ones reading the emails you send from work. We'll talk about how your employers are keeping track of what you write in a few minutes. Also, all this morning, we're talking about President Obama, who went to Congress last night to give details of his health care reform plan. What do you think the president left out? Or what resonated with you the most? Were you shaking your head?
Jim Monterano from Yorktown Heights, New York. I thought President Obama hit a home run last night. He appealed to people that really believe in change, and there are some people that will never support him, so they're not approachable. But I think the people he needed to win over, he won over last night.
Give us your review of this speech. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, some of the news stories we're following this morning, and here's Femi Okeh.
Thanks very much, Lynn. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. In the president's speech last night, he challenged his opponents in Congress to put aside partisan bickering and work with him on universal health care. The president also read excerpts of a letter from the late Ted Kennedy.
What we face, he wrote, is above all a moral issue. At stake are not just the details of policy, but fundamental principles of social justice and the character of our country.
In the official GOP response to the president's speech, Louisiana Representative Charles Bustani said that replacing family health care plans with a national model isn't the answer. Fresh data out this morning on the job market. The number of people filing for unemployment benefits was up more than expected last week. 550,000 people filed for jobless benefits. And numbers just out on the U.S. trade deficit in July jumped 16% to the highest amount since January. The U.S. trade deficit was $32 billion in July. And finally, in the weather, Hurricane Fred is expected to continue to lose strength and stay away from land as it churns in the Atlantic. Hurricane Linda continues its trek far out in the Pacific and is also expected to weaken quite soon. And those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
I'm Lynn Scherr, and it is Thursday, so we're talking about work. Okay, when you go to work, how many emails do you send in a day? Do you ever use all capital letters or maybe italics? Do you ever say anything personal in your emails? And what do those emails say about how useful and happy you are as an employee? Well, it turns out you can tell a lot about who you are as a worker by what's in those emails, and your employer may be keeping tabs. Here to tell us more is Elizabeth Charnock. She is the CEO of Catafora, and she says their software can tell how productive you are by monitoring not just your email, but your instant messages, even your key card use. We're also joined by Takeaway contributor Beth Kobliner, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Welcome to both of you. Elizabeth, let me go to you. This is shocking news to me. What exactly does your software do, and how does it do it?
Well, our software does a great many things. We originally started off doing investigation and litigation, where the stakes are often very high in millions or many millions of dollars. So people are much more than curious as to what their employees are doing. You know, might they be whistleblowers? Might they have it in for the company? Will they be friendly witnesses and so on? And so we started off modeling behavior to try to understand what normal behavior is so we could understand what abnormal behavior was.
Okay, first, just tell me, before we get into the specifics of what you can see online or in email, What does a happy, productive employee look like in terms of their email?
Whether it's emails or IMs, they're very connected to a number of different people, not just one or two. They are regularly consulted in what their job description is and what their area of expertise is. They are using many different channels, and not just from 9 to 5, but as things come up during the evening and even on weekends.
So this is the picture of the happy, productive, useful employee, right?
It's more than that. What we looked for and what our software looks for, really, are people whose contributions are being used over and over again by their colleagues. Something
so it's
that's
people,
useful is reused.
People emailing you for advice, to get your opinion on something, that sort of thing?
Exactly, as well as if you come up with a clever phrase, people repeating that phrase over and over again because it's useful, because it helps people to understand perhaps something that's very complicated.
Okay, before we move on to Beth, let me just get a couple of specifics from you. I know you have filters and you have ways of seeing what people are doing. Number one, what happens if you're the sort of person who writes in all caps? What does that mean?
It's like digital yelling.
It's like digital yelling. Okay, so it says you're a pretty emotional person.
Or you really want somebody to pay attention to the following sentence. And
okay.
You have no better way to do it.
You also have filters that can tell who you're communicating with and whether you have phone. Just tick off a couple of those things for me that you can determine.
We can determine anything from when you are confused, angry, by more terse sentence structure, by lots of exclamation points and other things like that.
When you say to somebody, call me on this?
Yes. And we have the notion of a call me event, meaning when somebody is trying to gently suggest it would really be better to not put this in writing. The software's smart enough to tell the difference between that and something like, please call me if you have any questions.
Well, I have to tell you, it's all very interesting, and it scares the heck out of me. This is
Absolutely.
Big brother, big sister, Beth Koblenner. What are we looking at here?
For sure, it's Orwellian. You know, I've been writing about workplace issues for close to 20 years, and I was shocked by doing the reporting on this, the depth and breadth at which employers are monitoring people. 70% of employers say in a recent study that they are doing this. They are looking at people's emails, personal emails. Basically, any time you use your office computer, even if you're using your own, say, Gmail account or AOL account, every time you use your office computer, that is not your material anymore.
This is no longer, if it ever was, this is not a matter of somebody sitting in a little room reading through everything. This is taking software like the Cataphora software, and it will just spit out, well, gee, Lynn Scherer has been doing an awful lot of call me things.
Contacting her friends, for example, in some cases, or doing personal emails, or knowing which websites you're looking at. And I think that it's become, you know, what's interesting to me is the privacy and consumer right advocates group have basically stopped fighting. They've given up because the courts have ruled this material, if you're using a work computer, not only at your desk at work, but if your company gives you a laptop computer and you're using it at home, or your company gives you a company BlackBerry, all that can be monitored and it's perfectly legal.
Elizabeth Charnock, what sorts of companies are using your services?
It's mostly large companies who are involved in litigation and who are deep pockets. And that may not sound like a very sympathetic clientele, but yet if one stupid employee brings down a heap of liability on their employer, that hurts the shareholders, it hurts other employees, it hurts everybody.
And Elizabeth, as far as you know, does any employer use this for, I don't know how to put this, gossip reasons?
No, life's too short, quite honestly.
Let's hope you're right about that one. Beth, let's go back to you. Advice for a worker bee. What do we do so as not to get in an embarrassing situation?
Well, first of all, you probably want to know whether your employer is doing this or not. Of course, then there's the question, if you ask your employer, are you monitoring my emails for personal information? The employer will be like, why are you asking? You know, what are you doing that's wrong? So it's sort of a little tricky there. But I'd say in the workplace, I learned this lesson. Only use your personal cell phone. Only use your personal BlackBerry if you're emailing people. And that's the way it has to be. And make sure you realize that just because you're using a personal Gmail account does not mean your employer is not monitoring it.
That's the takeaway. The employer has all the rights here. They own the computers. They own your email. Beth Kobliner is our contributor and an author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Elizabeth Charnock is CEO of Catafora, which makes software that monitors electronic correspondence. Thanks to both of you. So all this morning, we're also talking about President Obama's speech to Congress last night. He pitched his health care plan, but what do you think? Lewis emails us from New Jersey. In New Jersey, insurance companies can't deny you for a pre-existing condition, but if there's a lapse in your coverage, you aren't covered for any pre-existing condition for a time period. I wish Obama addressed that time period, since it's different for each insurance company. What's your review of the speech? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Lynn Scherr. This is The Takeaway. What were you listening for last night? Did you get enough details?
While there remain some significant details to be ironed out, I believe a broad consensus exists for the aspects of the plan I just outlined. Consumer protections for those with insurance, an exchange that allows individuals and small businesses to purchase affordable coverage, and a requirement that people who can afford insurance get insurance.
Getting down to specifics on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 10th. I'm Lynn Scherr, in for John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer on bank bailouts and financial freefalls. More on South Carolina's Congressman Joe Wilson, who shouted, "You lie," last night while President Obama was speaking. And from nanos to nano cameras, the newest gizmos from Apple. But first, good morning again to Faith Dow in San Francisco, California. Faith, you're an Obama supporter. You do not have health insurance. When we spoke to you yesterday, you weren't sure if you were going to support the president's health care plan. Did he say anything last night that changed your mind?
I was relieved to hear him say that everyone would be covered. However, I still want to know what the plan will end up looking like for us.
Faith Dow, freelance writer, please stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, plenty of news from the president's speech to Congress last night. He continued his push for universal health care, saying people should be required to have health insurance just as states require auto insurance. This morning, Vice President Joe Biden told NBC News that he expects the health care overhaul to happen.
I believe we will have a bill. I went to Congress a long, long time, been there for eight presidents. I think we'll have a bill before Thanksgiving.
But in the official GOP response to the president's speech, Louisiana Representative Charles Bustani said replacing family health care plans with a national model is not the answer. Turning to the economy, we have fresh numbers on the U.S. trade deficit. It jumped 16% in July to the highest level in 6 months. That's because of increased oil and auto imports. The trade deficit was $32 billion. On Capitol Hill, Congress hears testimony today on how the SEC bungled investigations into Wall Street swindler Bernie Madoff's business. An SEC report says the agency failed in its investigation of six complaints against him. And moving to the markets now, the markets were up slightly yesterday. The Dow opens this hour at 95.47, the S&P starts trade at 10.33, and the NASDAQ begins at 20.60. So President Obama went to Congress last night to give details of his health care reform plan. What do you think the president left out, and what resonated with you the most? Where were you shaking your head?
Obama speaks very, very well, but the fact of the matter is that I don't like the idea of a total takeover by government of the healthcare system, and I don't believe in socialism, and this is definitely, no question about it, socialism.
So what do you think? Socialism? Yes, no? What else? Give us your review of the speech. Tell us what it is at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Lynn Scherr in for John Hockenberry. Last night, the president made his pitch for health care reform before a joint session of Congress.
Everyone in this room knows what will happen if we do nothing. Our deficit will grow, more families will go bankrupt, more businesses will close. More Americans will lose their coverage when they are sick and need it the most, and more will die as a result. We know these things to be true.
We're going to talk to some of our listeners in just a moment who are watching this speech, just like you.
My name's Jared. I'm calling from Springfield, Massachusetts. I thought the president did great last night, and he gave enough details to get an idea of what the plan proposed is, but not too many details to pin him down and allow Congress to hammer out the end of the bill.
Give us your review of the speech. Tell us what you thought at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, we want to get some of the highlights from our Takeaway Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Todd joins us from member station WDET. And Todd, what were the main points that Mr. Obama made last night?
Well, the first thing, good morning, Lynn. He used the classic Obama soaring rhetoric. Now, he said, now is the season for action. Used a mixture of inspiration and, frankly, some shame on members of Congress, you know, sort of suggesting, you know, let's show people that we're worth our jobs by coming here and really getting this done. He did back some new policies, some of the stuff that's floating around on Capitol Hill, but that we haven't heard the president endorse before. He endorsed the idea of outlawing, denying coverage because of pre-existing conditions, outlawing, dropping people if they get sick. He did endorse a plan to keep the plan deficit neutral in the long term, and he did re-endorse the public option, even though he said he is willing to listen to other ideas. The other real big thing from the speech, Lynn, was the president did say he is still open to Republicans. His door is open, but he warned them that he's not going to waste his time with people who want to kill the bill. And around Capitol Hill, that's code for something very specific. In the Senate, you need 60 votes to pass something. The president has the option of using a process called reconciliation. We don't have to get into the procedure, but if they use it, it would be very unusual, and the president would only need 50 votes or 51 votes to pass his plan. They call it the nuclear option because it would destroy a lot of relationships around the Senate and in Washington. It's a very big deal. But he sort of put them on notice. I'm not going to waste time with you. And what he's saying is, I will push this red button if I have to. Don't test me.
Ready to go ahead without the Republicans if he has to. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, our thanks to you. As of 7:59 p.m. last night, before the speech, three of our listeners were unconvinced by the president. We wanted to check in with them today to see if they heard what they needed to from the president. Faith Dow is a freelance writer in San Francisco, and she voted for President Obama. Brad Bynum is a landscape architect in Oklahoma City. He is a registered Republican. They both joined us yesterday morning, so welcome back to both of you to the show. And we are also joined by Troy Erickson, a clerk for the U.S. Postal Service in Grand Forks, North Dakota. He's an independent voter who couldn't be with us yesterday because his wife was just having a baby. So congratulations to the newest Erickson. And let me start with Brad. Brad, we asked you yesterday what you wanted to hear from the president, and here's what you said.
Well, I think the basic thing is something clear-cut, and you hear all these different options of co-op or this or that, and, you know, I would at least like to know which direction he wants to go with it.
Okay, Brad, here is what the president said last night.
The plan I'm announcing tonight would meet three basic goals. It will provide more security and stability to those who have health insurance. It will provide insurance for those who don't. And it will slow the growth of health care costs for our families, our businesses, and our government.
Okay, Brad, you wanted clear cut. Good enough for you?
Well, I kind of wondered if he listened to the show yesterday. I mean, it pretty much addressed everything that I was talking about. He got specific enough to for me to understand what he wants. And plus, what I really enjoyed was the fact that he did reach across the table a lot. He continued to do that. And like I said, I was kind of tired of the bickering and stuff. And then he also took responsibility, personal responsibility for this bill of, in other words, my plan, this is what I want to do. In other words, he's standing for something. He's coming out and finally saying, this is what I want to do. I need y'all's help, and taking the proverbial bull by the horns, or I guess in this case it'd be the elephant by the tusk, and putting it in black and white. And yeah, Takeaway, if you put it on a ballot right now, yeah, I would vote for that. He fulfilled everything that I believed that I needed from yesterday's conversation.
Okay, Brad, one satisfied customer. Thanks very much to you, and I'll go along with you. I suspect the president was listening to the Takeaway and figured out what to say from there, so thanks. Faith Dow, freelance writer in San Francisco, here's what you were hoping for yesterday.
Insurance companies are notorious for finding reasons to deny coverage of people even after you've paid premiums. So I would like to see something that holds them accountable and that offers coverage to people without limitations.
Okay. Was President Obama listening to you?
Under this plan, it will be against the law for insurance companies to deny you coverage because of a pre-existing condition. As soon as I sign this bill, it will be against the law for insurance companies to drop your coverage when you get sick or water it down when you need it the most. They will no longer be able to place some arbitrary cap on the amount of coverage you can receive in a given year or in a lifetime.
Well, both sides of the aisle seem to like that one in Congress. Faith, what about you?
I am cautiously optimistic that we will get the coverage that we need.
Okay, Faith, thanks very much. I'm glad you heard what you were looking for, at least cautiously. Troy Erickson, clerk for the Postal Service in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Troy, quickly, what were you looking for yesterday, and did you get it?
Well, greetings from the Great Plains. My deal breakers going into the speech were no federal dollars to fund abortions, a meaningful recommitment kind of pledge to pass a bipartisan bill, and most importantly, perhaps, new information to make me believe that whole not a dime added to the deficit claim. And I'm willing to believe his no federal funds for abortion pledge, but the bipartisan pledge has to be placed in the I will believe it when I see it column, simply because it would be so easy for him to renege on that in the name of ensuring our lower-income citizens. And finally, that not a dime to the deficit claim is just untrue. I believe the Congressional Budget Office analysis indicates that something like $245 billion needed to adjust Medicare reimbursement rates appears nowhere on the Democratic overhaul balance sheet.
So not entirely satisfied. Troy Erickson, first of all, congratulations on your new baby.
Well, actually, the baby is not out yet. What my wife experienced early yesterday morning was just a long, uncomfortable false labor, unfortunately. But
we wish you the best of luck for the real one.
Thank you.
Okay, Troy Erickson, thanks so much for joining us. Takeaway, we're 2 out of 3 for the president, so not too bad. Let's move on now over to Detroit. And in the current mediascape of the Glenn Becks and the Bill O'Reillys and, yeah, the Keith Olbermans, leave it to our friends at member station WDET to host what sounded like an actual informative town hall last night.
We feel that you need to get the facts in a clear, objective way without the political spin and the rhetoric that goes along with this. So I ask you to listen to our panelists, ask questions, and ultimately, the decision on the type of health reform we have in this country will be up to you. It's your choice.
Craig Folley moderated the panel last night. Craig, from your perspective, how did it go?
Lynn, good morning. I think it went actually quite well last night. Weren't quite sure what to expect, frankly, with these town hall meetings being the way that they have been. But we seem to attract a lot of people that were genuinely curious about how any health care reform that may come out might impact them and, frankly, how much it's going to cost. People had real questions, didn't have a lot of screaming, and certainly didn't have people holding up signs and comparing politicians to nefarious politicians of the past.
What's your secret? How did you make it so civil when all these other noisy town halls were happening all over the country within the last month or two?
Well, I think one of the important things that we decided to do when we were planning this was not have any politicians there. We brought in experts, people that know health care, know the business side of it, know the economics of it, and, of course, the delivery of health care services, and have them look at the legislation, answer questions, direct questions from the audience, and frankly, there was nobody to yell at on the stage, and I think that had a lot to do with it.
So all in all, what were the major concerns of the folks in Detroit last night?
Well, you know, frankly, I think just like they have been for a lot of people around the country, just they were articulated a little bit better last night. People are concerned about what's going to happen to their coverage, if they're going to be eligible for coverage, if any of their coverage is going to be taken away, and frankly, is this going to cost me any more money?
Thanks so much. Craig Folly, host of WDET in Detroit.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Lynn Scherr, and it's Thursday, so that means we're talking about technology here on The Takeaway. Yesterday, Apple revealed its new line of iPod products, but it wasn't the news about the new nano camera that stole the show. It was the starkly slim guy in the black T-shirt and jeans, and yes, that would be Apple CEO Steve Jobs making this statement.
5 months ago, I had a liver transplant, so I now have the liver of a mid-20s person who died in a car crash and was generous enough to donate their organs. And I wouldn't be here without such generosity. I hope all of us can be as generous and elect to become organ donors.
Jobs got a standing ovation when he said that. And we are joined now by Stephen Levy, a senior writer at Wired, who was at the event. Stephen is also author of the book, The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Culture, Commerce, and Coolness. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you.
So Stephen Jobs has never been one to openly gush about personal information. What's your take on why he chose to do so yesterday?
Well, you're absolutely correct. He normally doesn't go in that direction, but this was a pretty unusual event. It was his return, public return, to the role of CEO and even maybe more important, main salesman of Apple after this break, where a lot of people thought he wouldn't come back at all. And he wanted to let us all know that he was back and, you know, acknowledge the elephant in the room in this case.
And he didn't just talk about what happened to him. I mean, this is amazing. He also had this to say yesterday.
So I'm vertical. I'm back at Apple, loving every day of it. And I'm getting to work with our incredibly talented teams to come up with some great new products for you all in the future. So it's wonderful.
I'm vertical. Stephen Levy, this is pretty unusual, isn't it, for a corporate conference?
Well, it is unusual. And if you take a step back and take a look at, you know, the nature of the products that they announced, they really didn't announce any products. They announced upgrades to existing products, and they weren't terribly radical in of themselves. They're all very nice improvements. Particularly, you mentioned the camera and the Nano, which is a very interesting development, and it'll help the iPod for the Christmas season. But there were thousands of people, probably 1,000 people at this event. People came from all over the world, lots of cameras, big registrations. It's really unthinkable that any other company but Apple would have an event of that scale for an announcement of this level. It really was about Steve, I think.
So the takeaway is that Steve Jobs was saying, I'm back and I'm in charge. Stephen Levy from Wired Magazine, thanks so much for joining us. Okay, now we're switching the conversation, the tech conversation, to cell phones. Scientists are of mixed opinion as to whether or not the radiation they emit is harmful. And while the scientists argue it out, the nonprofit Environmental Working Group has released an analysis that shows how 1,000 models of cell phones currently on the market rank in terms of the amount of radiation they give off. Very important news. Joining us now to discuss these rankings are Richard Wiles, Senior Vice President of Policy and Communication for the Environmental Working Group. And we're also speaking with Louis Slessen, editor of MicrowaveNews.com, an online publication that covers the health effects of electromagnetic radiation. So, gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me here.
Richard, why don't we start with you? Give us the nitty-gritty of the analysis. This is what we all want to know. Which cell phones create the most radiation?
Well, the ones that create the most tend to be the bigger devices, the BlackBerries and the iPhones and those kind of things. I don't have the list memorized, but that's the general rule. Samsung has a lot of phones at the low end. You know, those tend to be the smaller phones. But the other thing that people should know is that one simple way that you can protect yourself from the radiation is to use a headset or an earpiece, which will remove the phone from basically direct contact with your head.
This is the earphone possibility is something that we all learned about a number of years ago. Has the quality improved at all? It's been pretty horrible.
You mean do they work better?
Yeah, right.
That detail. You know, my earpiece works fine. I know people have some trouble with them, but, you know, I think they're getting better all the time.
Okay, fine. Richard, before we move on to the health effects here, there was so much traffic on your website yesterday, it noticeably slowed down. Why do you think people are so eager for this information?
Well, there's 4 billion cell phone users in the world. People want to keep using their cell phones, and we recommend that. But this is I think people have a sense that this is a real concern. I think it's intuitive, and the science is beginning to back them up more and more as we have studies that cover a longer period of use.
Okay, Richard Wiles, Senior Vice President of Policy and Communication for the Environmental Working Group. Thanks for that information. I want to turn now to Louis Slessen, editor of Microwave News. Online publication covering radiation. How bad is this radiation for us?
The real answer is we don't know. And my view is we should find out as soon as we can. As the gentleman said, the 3 to 4 billion people using them, and we don't know. Even a small risk would be a major problem.
Do we have any indication that an earpiece actually makes a difference rather than holding the phone up to your ear?
Absolutely. It makes anything that takes the phone away from your head, so the radiation plume, if you will, does not go into your head, does not touch your brain, your eyes, and various other parts of your head. That's a good thing. So moving it away. But one thing, when you use your hands-free set, don't put the phone in your pocket. Try and keep it away from your body. If you keep it in your pocket, it's still near your body, and you're getting radiated there. Anytime you're using the phone, it's radiating.
I'm sitting here moving my BlackBerry to the other side of the desk. So it's not just the delicate part of my body, like my head in my ears, but any part of my body is a problem.
Well, there's a lot of research coming out suggesting that, you know, men's fertility could be affected by this radiation, or at least by the phones in some way, and that suggests that if you have the phone in your pocket, there may be a problem. We don't know, but there are a lot of questions that need to be worked out.
Louis Slessen, the editor of MicrowaveNews.com, an online publication that covers the health effects of electromagnetic radiation. Thanks to you. I think the takeaway here is read the report, get an earpiece for your phone. And now we move on to the headlines with Femi Oke.
It's almost 29 minutes past the hour. In last night's healthcare address, the president challenged his opponents in Congress to work with him to introduce universal healthcare. The president said the size of the health insurance plan would be $900 billion over 10 years. And this morning on NBC, Vice President Joe Biden said that a public option is the best way to get affordable health insurance for the uninsured. The vice president says that he believes there will be a healthcare bill before Thanksgiving. And finally, in economic news, the U.S. trade deficit jumped to its highest level in 6 months, up 16% to $32 billion in July. That's a look at some of the top stories we're following this morning. Lynn.
Thanks, Femi. And who's that man who interrupted the president saying you lie last night? Coming up.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Lynn Scherr, in for John Hockenberry. Last night, during President Obama's speech, someone you've probably never heard of made a name for himself.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally.
That person shouting is Joe Wilson. He is a Republican representative for South Carolina's 2nd District, which runs from Columbia, the capital, down to Hilton Head. But who is Joe Wilson? For the answer, let's talk to someone who knows him pretty well. Mark Quinn is the host of South Carolina ETV's and radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture. Mark, welcome to you, but Joe who?
Joe who? Lynn, last night when I heard after the speech that it was Joe Wilson who had made that comment, I was floored. I'll be honest with you, this is not the type of behavior you would expect from him. I've done some debates with Joe Wilson, and he's soft-spoken. He's mild-mannered. He's not a demagogue. He certainly is a very strong conservative, you know, from a pretty ruby-red district. I've been with him in a debate before where you almost wanted to poke him and say, hey, Joe, wake up.
So,
you know, if you get his heart rate over 60, you know, you're doing something right.
So this is not a guy who you would have thought could make the Speaker of the House of Representatives blanch.
Oh, my gosh. No, not at all. For him to even raise his voice, it shocked me to a large degree. He's had some town hall meetings here in town. He's even gone into enemy territory. And most of these were pretty civil. You know, the crowds didn't show up with pitchforks. He didn't stoke the anger like some other congressmen here in South Carolina have. This was totally, I would say, out of character. I think people were fairly shocked because, again, he's just a mild-mannered guy.
All right.
He doesn't have a great legislative record. So Mark, he's not even really well-known in the state.
But, Mark Quinn, the host of South Carolina's and radio's public radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture. Let me read something to you. We just got an email from Peter who says, and I quote, Mark, I was shocked and angered at the You Lie outburst by Congressman Joe Wilson. It got me thinking that South Carolina has produced many hotheads. In 1856, South Carolina Congressman Preston Brooks beat Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts nearly to death on the floor of the Senate. Oh, Mark, you have quite a history.
He did it with a cane. That's true.
So wait a minute. We're talking about a bad place here.
Well, you know, Lynn, this has not been a good year for South Carolina. I'll be very honest with you. Between Mark Sanford and our governor's tryst down to Argentina, and maybe the impending impeachment of our governor, this happens. The first thing I turn on today's show, Congressman Joe Wilson calls the president a liar.
Okay, so Mark, you've got some explaining to do, as they say, but stand by. So how did America's Congress get to be actually normally pretty polite to the president? You know, if you've listened to Parliament or watched Parliament sessions in Britain, they have no trouble speaking out to the prime minister. Let's go to Kathleen Hall Jamieson for the answer. She's director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Presidents Creating the Presidency, Deeds Done in Words. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Oh, one of the answers to your question is that the parliamentary system has conventionalized the questioning period in which there are vigorous exchanges between the prime minister and the members. And as a result, one has an expectation rhetorically that there is an appropriate level of hostility in exchange.
So they're asking for it.
Well, they've set up a structure in which it's expected, but there are boundaries within that as well. In the United States, however, when the president comes to a joint session of Congress, you're dealing with a moment in which all three branches of government are coming together, and the assumption is it's going to be a deliberative moment. In general, however, the House of Representatives and the Senate themselves are civil institutions. It is unusual to have exchanges that are inappropriate on the floor of either. There have been periods in which there was more of it. There was more of it after the turnover in the 104th, when the Republicans took over after 40 years of Democratic rule in the 1990s. But there are rules in place in the House to minimize the likelihood that it happens.
And are there any repercussions for this kind of outburst?
Yes. If this member had stood up on the floor during regular House session and called another member a liar, there would have been an automatic taking down process, a process by which you formally censure the individual for violating rules that were originally formulated by Thomas Jefferson. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't times on the floor in which things have been said about the president that have been inappropriate. Congressman Bob Dornan, former Congressman Bob Dornan, then Congressman from California, for example, in the 1990s, accused President Clinton of giving aid and comfort to the enemy. In other words, he alleged that the president had engaged in treason. There was an automatic taking down process, and Congressman Dornan was not allowed to speak for the rest of the day. And so there are rules in place to ensure that the institution maintains the boundaries of civility that are required if you're going to deliberate. Once you've called someone a liar, there is no further conversation that is going to take place on any form of legislation. You've impugned the person's integrity. There's no point in talking at that point.
And talking about the historical aspect, the outburst from Congressman Joe Wilson had his colleagues really, really mad. Take a listen.
I have never in my 29 years heard an outburst of that nature with reference to a president of the United States speaking as a guest of the House and Senate.
And that was Steny Hoyer, Democrat, of course, of Maryland, the House Majority Leader, in an interview. This has really got people angry. But, Kathleen, I must say, when you talk about Bob Dornan from California, our friend Mark Quinn, we want to make it clear this is not just South Carolinians, right?
Hope not. But let me say, Lynn, you know, this may seem like an outdated notion, but here in the South, Southern gentlemen just don't act this way, not in public anyway. Behind closed doors, you say what you want, but, you know, in public, this is conduct unbecoming of a Southern gentleman, I'll say.
Kathleen, go ahead, Kathleen.
Yeah, we looked across the history of the United States House of Representatives from 1946 through 1996 and then through 2000. And we found no difference by states in the number of times that someone was taken down in the formal censure process. So I think historically, South Carolina is safe.
Okay. Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, University of Pennsylvania, and Mark Quinn from South Carolina Educational TV and Radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture. Thanks very much to you both. And now we go for even more headlines to Femi. Okay, Femi.
Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. In last night's health care address, the president challenged his opponents in Congress to work with him to introduce universal health care. He repeated a proposal for a federally operated insurance policy exchange. He said people who don't have insurance through their employer will be encouraged to buy plans on the exchange. Overseas, a suicide bomber has driven a truck packed with explosives into a village in northern Iraq, killing at least 19 people and wounding more than 30. The main challenger in the Afghan presidential election, Abdullah Abdullah, has accused President Hamid Karzai of manipulating the commission that is counting the votes. Speaking with our partner, the BBC, Mr. Abdullah said the election was being stolen from the Afghan people. The Election Commission has recently issued its first order to exclude ballots from the final count. And that is a look at some of the stories we're tracking this morning. Lynn.
Thanks, Femi. Coming up, last year, this country was sent into a financial collapse. Coming up, are we protected from a future one? What about the banks? More about that in 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scherr. Okay, Don Juan, time to roll over. It has come to this. In Spain, the country's health minister has called for a stop to the traditional greeting of kisses on both cheeks, all that to help prevent the spread of H1N1. Well, should we be adopting something similar and put a stop to, shaking hands or hugging or even kissing when we greet someone to help prevent the spread of swine flu? Joining us now is Sewell Chan from our partner, The New York Times. And Sewell, so what happens when we're trying to do the right thing and still trying to have a social society?
Well, there could be a potential breakdown in the social order, I suppose. but the biggest concern that doctors have is that when you shake hands, it's not so much that your skin is touching the other person's skin. It's that if you're in contact within, 3 to 5 feet of someone who might be infected with swine flu, the droplets from their mouth could end up on your hand. And surprisingly, we end up touching our hands dozens, even hundreds of times a day without knowing that. And it could touch your eyes if you rub your eyes, your nose if you, touch your nose, your mouth if you're, holding your chin in your hands. And it could really end up making contact with your mucous membranes. And that's the concern doctors have.
So is it really about touching another person or is it about just getting, if somebody sneezes, the spray, the vapor, if you're in close contact in a subway, something like that? Or is it from touching? So here I am, I'm going to touch something on the desk, and without even thinking about it, my hand goes into my mouth or near my eyes.
It's more the latter concern. But if you think about the number of greetings that we exchange each day, from people we are standing next to in the subway to colleagues that we don't know very well but feel obliged to shake hands with, to intimate partners, family members, certainly small children who one cannot avoid hugging even if they're sneezing and coughing, it's very hard to get yourself out of situations in which you might be vulnerable.
What about if we all obsessively wash our hands with all that antibiotic stuff? Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
It's certainly a good idea. Nothing is recommended more highly than constant hand washing.
But with the little stuff that comes in the little jars, or, in fact, is it just plain soap? Because what about the argument that we're killing off the antibodies that we need, the germs that we need on our body to build up our resistance?
The doctors I spoke to don't think that Purell and the other alcohol-based cleansers actually are harmful in terms of building up our antibodies. They say that soap and water is the best option, but for people on the road, including politicians, sometimes Purell is the best option.
So after you've done one of these meet and greets, quickly wash your hands, get rid of it, all those bad germs?
Straight away. Just don't tell the person you're doing it.
And what about protection when you're riding the subway, when you're out on the street?
Well, those are some of the most difficult interactions, and that was the focus of an article I recently wrote that talked about whether people might do things instead of handshake. For example, the fist bump, which the Obamas perhaps made popular during last year's campaign season, is actually safer, according to the doctors I talked to, than the handshake, because there are less likely to be germs and flu virus on the outside of your hands than on the inside.
Oh, it's going to be a different world we live in, is it not? I want to say thank you. I'll give you a little across-the-table fist bump here. Sewell Chan, thanks so much from our partner, The New York Times. What a strange winter we're going in for. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lynn.
I always have to steal my kisses from you. Always have to steal my kisses from you. I always have to steal my kisses from you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Lynn Scherr. Coming up, are there regulations in place to protect America from another economic collapse? We'll find out more in a few minutes with New York's ex-governor, Eliot Spitzer. We're also talking about health care. President Obama went to Congress last night to give details of his plan. What do you think the president left out? What resonated with you the most? Or where were you shaking your head?
Hi, this is Paul Kleiser from Atlantic Highlands. I wanted to say that there's been no addressing cost at all, and none of the players want to give up anything, which leads me to suspect that we'll give up everything.
What do you think? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, let's check in on today's top news stories. Here's Femi Okeh with the headlines.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, the president's speech to Congress last night continued his push for universal health care, saying that people should be required to have health insurance just as states require auto insurance. Louisiana Congressman Charles Bustani gave the official GOP response to the address.
Replacing your family's current health care with government-run health care is not the answer. In fact, it'll make healthcare much more expensive.
Bustani said that it's a mistake to keep pushing the public plan. In economic news, we have fresh numbers on the U.S. trade deficit. It jumped 16% in July to the highest level in 6 months, and that's because of increased oil and auto imports. The trade deficit was $32 billion. In auto news, GM ended months of speculation today, saying it will sell its German Opel unit to the Canadian auto parts maker Magna. GM says that it needs more guarantees from the German government for the deal. And finally, sleeping with your partner could be bad for your health. It's okay, it's not Lynn. She hasn't fallen asleep during the news.
I'm wide awake.
Sleep specialist Dr. Neil Stanley says that couples should consider sleeping in separate beds to get more sleep. So not only is this horrible background noise that you hear in the snoring going on at bed at different, going to bed at different times, hogging the sheets, all contribute to poorer sleep. And Dr. Stanley said that we were never meant to share our beds. The idea of the shared marital bed came out of the Industrial Revolution because in cities there wasn't quite as much space for two beds. And in one recent study, he says that 50% of couples who slept together slept worse than sleeping apart. And that's the look at the stories we're following this morning. You can wake up.
Our system basically failed its most fundamental tests. It was too fragile, too vulnerable to shock.
We're going to have to save those banks.
Save those banks.
Save those banks.
Even if we cash out the guys that took the big bonuses.
When they fail, they get a bonus. The taxpayer gets the bill.
All week long, we've been reviewing the year that marked the beginning of the financial meltdown and the recession that we continue to live through. Today, we're taking stock of how the nation's banks are managing, 1 year after the government spent billions of taxpayer dollars to bail them out. For a look at what regulations need to be in place to avoid future financial freefalls, we turn to Eliot Spitzer. He is the former attorney general, the ex-governor of New York. We are also joined by Tyler Cowen. He is a professor of economics at George Mason University and author of the new book, Create Your Own Economy, The Path to Prosperity in a Disordered World. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Eliot Spitzer, let me start with you. 1 year after we bailed out these big financial institutions that were supposedly too big to fail, they're getting bigger and bigger. What's going on?
Well, I totally agree with the premise and what you just said. They were too big to fail before. They're still too big to fail. There was no question we're going to bail out the banks, and we have put trillions of dollars into the financial system. The question is, are we getting the reform that we need? And unfortunately, the answer is no, we are not. We are rebuilding the same edifice, the same structures, the same government guarantees implicitly behind what these banks do, because if they were to begin to founder today, once again, we would have to step in. The government has not, and I have not yet seen a plan that says, here's how we're going to fundamentally restructure the financial services sector so the next time round we do not face the same problem.
What do you think needs to be done?
I wrote an article a long time ago, and I'm not the only one. Many, many people have said too big to fail is too big. Let us finally take a hard look at a system of financial concentration that became the policy of this government 10 or 15 years ago, where banks were permitted to merge to the point where they became such enormous structures. Let us finally say you cannot be that big. You should not be that interconnected, which is the word that is used these days, basically the same thing. You can break them down on regional lines, break them down on business lines. You can basically say you will not be guaranteed next time, so they of a natural course, economic pressure would force them apart. There's nothing that says they have to be this big. This is a conversation going on in other countries.
Who should be doing this?
The federal government. There's no question that the Treasury Department, the Fed. Look, let's be very clear. The Fed failed. Right now, everybody's saying the Fed has saved us by printing trillions of dollars. The Fed is the very institution that was supposed to be monitoring this, along with the Treasury Department. They utterly failed to do it.
We're talking to Eliot Spitzer, former Attorney General and former Governor of New York State. Let us go now to Tyler Cowen, Professor of Economics at George Mason University. Mr. Cowen, what do you think? Banks too big to fail? Are they bigger and bigger? Should they be more regulated?
The key is to reintroduce market discipline and let creditors know that if their counterparties fail, they will take a loss. We've been bailing out institutions since at least the 1990s. I don't think making them smaller is the answer. Lehman was not that big. And if you go back to long-term capital management in 1998, we bailed them out, and they were a very small firm. So I don't think shrinking banks is the answer. The most we can do is have some very simple restrictions on leverage and send the message that bailouts will not be automatic.
Do you have objections to what Mr. Spitzer is suggesting about letting having the Fed get in there and do more?
Well, it is the Fed's responsibility, but I think the key problem lies in Congress, not the regulators. Regulators respond to their congressional committees, and Congress for too long has decided that as long as jobs are being created in their district or more people are buying homes, that all is well, and that's a big mistake. But it's Congress that needs reform, not the Fed.
I don't think we fundamentally disagree. Congress obviously put pressure on the Fed and other regulatory agencies to act in a particular way, but the Fed was supposed to be the repository of wisdom on this issue and was supposed to look out for systemic risk, which is obviously what brought us down. You are correct. It is not only scale, it is the fact of the bailouts, but the bailouts by the Fed were predicated on the notion that Lehman was too interconnected, or so we thought it was too interconnected. We found out, in fact, it was. AIG was too interconnected, and so therefore they said interconnected equals big equals bailout. You're right. The bailouts, what we call the socialization of risk and the privatization of gain, so that asymmetry, take all the risk you want, if it goes bad, we'll bail you out, but you keep the upside, that has not worked as an economic principle. That is not market discipline.
But gentlemen, isn't what both of you are saying, it seems to me, for all the specifics that we need to deal with, part of it is that we as consumers trusted. We trusted the banks to be in doing what they're doing. We trusted the government and the regulatory agencies to do what they – who are we left to trust, and where are we at this point?
Well, look, I hate to jump in, but years ago, back when I was attorney general, I said I would not trust the SEC to do a house closing for me. And now after we read the report about Madoff – and back when I said that, of course, people said, oh, you're being too edgy. And the fact of the matter is the federal regulatory system utterly failed. It was captured by the industry, and you had bankers. And when you look at what they did and you look at the AIG bailout – and you're right about the counterparties. AIG got $80 billion, went straight through to the counterparties. They were paid 100%. Nobody to this day has explained why Goldman Sachs got a check for $12.9 billion, 100% of the counterparty risk that it supposedly had taken. Why? Goldman says it wasn't at risk. Why did we give them the money? Government bailed out. The Fed failed. The SEC failed. Who do we trust? At this point, very few people in the federal government.
Elliot Spitzer, former AG, Attorney General, and former Governor of New York. And we're also talking to Tyler Cowen, Professor of Economics at George Mason. Professor Cowen, go ahead.
I would just note consumers were actually part of the problem, that many of us were caught up in the euphoria and the bubble, and many people thought they could take on more debt and buy any house they want and put down maybe zero money. And it's easy enough to blame the banks, the regulators. All those criticisms make sense, but the problem was more systemic. It was an overall excess of optimism and complacency in the entire economy, including consumers.
To Tyler, you're absolutely right, and the history of bubbles is that everybody gets swept along and we all buy into the same groupthink, which is somehow risk can be absorbed and there will never be a day when we have to pay the price, and unfortunately
right.
We find out otherwise.
Gentlemen, thanks to both of you. Last question for you, Elliot Spitzer. You've been back in the public eye recently, speaking, writing, teaching. Some rumors, any truth that you're going to run for public office again?
No, I enjoy participating in the debate and lending my voice when I'm asked to do so. That's it.
Elliot Spitzer, former Attorney General, former Governor of New York, also Tyler Cowen, Professor of Economics at George Mason University, author of the new book, Create Your Own Economy, co-author of the economics blog, Marginal Revolution. Thanks to both of you. Tomorrow, we continue talking about the financial meltdown, year one, with Elizabeth Warren, chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel in charge of the Troubled Assets Relief Program, TARP. All this morning, we're also talking about President Obama's speech to Congress last night. He pitched his health care plan, but what do you think?
This is Melanie in South Carolina. I am so tired of this socialism garbage. What is Medicare? Can I just have Medicare then? Can everybody just have Medicare? Would that be okay with the people who are scared of socialism?
Here's what another one of you said.
This is Alice Barker. I'm from South Carolina, and I enjoyed Obama's speech, except for the possible increase in my taxes. But I was once again embarrassed to be from South Carolina, thanks to Joe Wilson.
Well, keep those comments coming, folks. We want to hear from all of you at thetakeaway.org. I'm Lynn Scherr. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.